So, it's interesting that when we think of the Buddha and his spiritual path, probably the first tool that comes to mind is meditation. When actually, of all the spiritual tools that the Buddha offered, meditation is the one that, when we have an advanced, developed spiritual practice, is the one that we practice the least frequently. Because all the other tools he offered were tools that could be done throughout the entire course of the day. Meditation, we might do for an hour or half an hour a day. It doesn't matter what level you're at. It's not going to be something that you do 18 hours a day. But mindfulness certainly is, which means awareness of what's going on inside, staying at least aware of how much stress and tension we're carrying, cultivating harmless intentions, noticing how we're creating and paying attention to thoughts that cause us more stress and suffering, worrying about things that we don't or couldn't possibly have the answer to. Right livelihood certainly is very important. Noticing how our work and our endeavors add stress or develop ease in our lives. Tonight I'd like to talk about speech, which is certainly an opportunity. Every interaction we have throughout the course of our lives is an opportunity for our practice. And the point of our practice is to develop peace of mind. Buddhism is not about placating some god. It's fine if you believe in God, but that's not what Buddha's practice is about. The Buddha didn't teach anything to make a god happy. He taught everything for the purpose of one thing, which he says, all of my teachings flow in one direction, which is towards ending stress and suffering. So that's why we practice. We don't practice to save the world. We're not practicing to make God or gods happy, or goddesses or whatever. We're not. That's not the point. The point is that speech, the way we interact with other beings, is very much one of the areas where we can reduce or amplify the amount of discomfort in our lives. We can't hope to have a peaceful mind if we're leading a very compartmentalized life, by which I mean it's nice to think that, oh, I come to Dharma Punks and there's all those, you know, nice-looking people who are, you know, looking for happiness within, so I can be very patient and generous, and, oh, yes, you can sit right there, and, oh, it's all right, you stepped on my foot, that's okay. It's so nice, you know, like we put on our yoga faces. Oh, it's so nice. Like all the yoga teachers I've ever had. Oh, it's so good to see. I'm like, I don't even know you. But anyway, so and then on the other hand, when we're on our commute in the subway or at work we might be frightened and stressed. At commute we might be, stay out of my space, you know. Get out of my way. You're an obstacle. Why are you walking this slow? Why are you walking that fast, you know? So we have a very compartmentalized attitude in life. And I have to admit that I've noticed that it's those areas where I'm the most external and feel the most vulnerable that I tend to be the most easily triggered. on my bike. That's when I pretty much commute everywhere on my bike, and of course when you're on your bike, or when I'm on my bike, I'm very externally vigilant, and it's very easy to conceive of cars as vaguely threatening when you're on your bike. So it's very easy to feel, to become triggered by interactions. And so it's very important for me to bring mindfulness into that arena, which means notice how much stress I'm carrying, and bring wisdom, which is to remind myself before I say or do anything, is this an interaction that I'm going to feel good about down the line? Is this something that I want to encourage in my behavior? We can't have a compartmentalized spiritual practice or spiritual life, because harmfulness, anger, aggression, judgmentalism, having a short temper, all these things are sort of like pollution, in the sense that they don't observe, you know, boundaries. They don't observe, if my neighbor is polluting, it's going to get into my... To my place. It doesn't just stay over there. So we can't compartmentalize. If I'm easy to provoke when I'm on the phone with a family member, when my buttons get pushed at work, when I'm easily finding myself exaggerating or saying things that are untrue to get out of situations where I feel culpable, I'm more likely to do that elsewhere in my life. And I'm more likely to add guilt and stress and discomfort. So we have to envision all of the arena of our life holistically, not as little parts where here, well, yeah, I didn't feel good about that, but that's what happens when I'm on my way to work. Also, the way we talk influences the way we think. If I'm short-tempered with you, I will be short-tempered with myself. If I'm judgmental of you, I will be judgmental of myself. If I'm dishonest with you, I'm more likely to be dishonest with myself. Finally, as the Buddha said, the third is simply that if I engage unskillfully with you, the chances are somewhere down the line you might do the same with me. So there's many reasons why we want to conceive of being aware of the way we interact with others in terms of a spiritual opportunity, which means an opportunity to express mindfulness, awareness of what's going on inside, and wisdom, awareness of what are the future implications or whether the way I'm about to speak is useful or not. So the Buddha said there's four kinds of unskillful speech that I'm going to go over. The first is dishonest speech. And it's sort of important to get this one addressed first, because the Buddha said of all the people that he taught, the one he couldn't teach was somebody who was perpetually or given to dishonesty. He brought in Angulimala, who was a serial killer, into the Sangha and taught him. But he wouldn't teach somebody who was a notorious liar, because he believed that lying and dishonesty cut to the core of our being, our ability to understand the Dharma, the truth, and to develop wisdom. So I looked up, I was reading this yesterday, I looked up, they had a poll of the most prevalent lies that people tell. They asked people to type in their lies into the internet, and they tabulated them in terms of the most popular. It wasn't me. You haven't changed a bit. I never got your message. That looks so good on you. Yes, one size fits all. I only need 5 minutes of your time. I never said that. Give me your number and I'll call you right back. Your money will be cheerfully refunded. Let's have lunch sometime. I was just kidding. And I was only trying to help. So, when we engage in not only lying, but it's also simply fudging the truth all the way to exaggeration, where we embellish how difficult something was. There's two reasons why we engage in dishonesty. The first is we're trying to avoid culpability. We feel that we've perhaps trespassed on some egregious behavior. Look at that wonderful vocabulary my parents paid for. And we feel slightly awkward about acknowledging something. That's generally what is behind dishonesty, avoiding acknowledging something that we've done. An exaggeration, in my experience, is generally, though, an attempt to get somebody's attention. We don't feel that our experience was interesting enough or important enough, so we don't say, you know, ooh, I had a hard time getting here. We said, ooh, the traffic was the worst ever! Because we feel that simply saying, well, it was difficult, nobody will pay attention. So we embroider and embellish until we create a biblical state of affairs that we had to endure to get through a day. You wouldn't believe the day I had! So we're trying to either get out of something or get attention. When we do this, we're identifying with that really small, diminished part of the mind that feels vulnerable. If I feel I need to be dishonest, or the only way I can get through a conversation with you is by creating a different view of what's occurred, then I'm really identifying with that small little six-year-old in me, that child that feels that it can't survive acknowledging guilt or missteps, or that feels that nobody will pay attention to it. So every time I engage in unskillful speech, I'm really, especially dishonesty and exaggeration, I'm making the mind smaller and more vulnerable, because I'm identifying with that part of me that feels constantly threatened. On the other hand, if I simply say, yeah, I got your message and I didn't call you back, I was busy, you know, that's not identifying and shrinking the mind around a small, little, frightened child. It's acknowledging. It's being fully adult and present. And knowing that even if we do something that somebody is not thrilled with, it doesn't mean that we're less of a human being or a person. So it's really important to identify with the voices that we will make us feel good about ourselves and make us grow. And those are the voices that own up. Those are the voices that believe our experience was enough, that we don't need to we don't need to embellish or change or not acknowledge what our role has been. The second is harmful speech, which is basically the desire to cause suffering for somebody else, to inflict some kind of stress. Often what happens is we've endured something that we're really uncomfortable with, and this energy in the body builds up, and it's building up through the body, and we want to get it out onto somebody else. We want to displace the energy. We want I want you to suffer as much as I'm suffering. It's this very naive idea that I can get the tension out of me somehow if it's vomited onto you. That's what anger is. Of course, we justify anger in two ways. We say, well, it gets attention, and people shouldn't get away with things. In my experience, it does neither. It's almost entirely ineffectual, because whenever, in my experience, I speak out of anger, what it does is it makes you defensive. It makes you less open, in fact, to see how I'm uncomfortable, unhappy, I feel mistreated, or whatever. All that happens when I'm putting my anger at you is you're putting up walls. And you're more likely to simply shut down or to engage in anger too, or to simply flee or whatever. But it doesn't create understanding. It doesn't create a bridge. And it doesn't, most importantly, get rid of the discomfort in me. Every time I've, in my own experience, spoken out of anger, it's still there. It might for a moment feel, because I'm so focused on the other person, but then as I walk away, I almost invariably feel shitty. So it's ineffectual. It doesn't work. Every time I speak out of anger, I'm identifying with that voice, that small little voice in my head that says it's not fair unless everybody is suffering. It's not fair. Somehow I'm being mistreated and it's your fault. That's a very, very small little naive voice. And it's a voice that almost always, rather than being one that I should indulge, it's a voice that I should nurture. See that it's there. None of this is about squashing anger. The goal is to feel anger, especially in its embodied state. Feel the energy rising. Feel the discomfort. But stop it before it comes out. Right when it gets there, right when you're about to push the send button on the email. My habit is to send it to myself. And I'm invariably happy that I didn't send it to somebody else. It is a good habit. I have to say that the social network has created an entire new channel for unskillful behavior. I was talking about exaggeration earlier. The Facebook is an entire arena based upon the notion that we get to create an entirely false version of ourselves for everybody to see. Look, here's me at the parties where everybody's laughing at everything I say, and people are girls are on my lap, and here's me, you know. And basically the idea is that, oh, well, yeah, my life is largely you know, going to work, waking up, doing the laundry on Sunday, you know. At least I get to have this shiny version of myself. On Facebook, here's me with the mountains. And here's me in Europe, you know. Here's me in the short skirt or the, you know, with the tough leather jacket, you know. We create this image of ourselves because we secretly feel that, you know, a lot of our lives is not that attractive. So that's an entirely wonderful arena as well, to practice just being more open and honest about things that we would, you know, that we're not so proud about. I wish instead of people saying, sending me what they ate today, this is what I ate today. I've never, I'm sorry to those of you who send out what I ate today, but I don't care. I just, Julian, I care about you because he eats weird things and it's so interesting, but the rest of you, he's always with like some juicer, you know, like I juiced a rock today, and it, you know, so it's interesting. But the rest of you, I don't want to know. And, but if you center around today, you know, today secretly I thought, you know, blah blah blah, and instead I did this, and I found out that it created less suffering in my life, I'd find that kind of interesting. I really would. A little spiritual nugget sometimes that's, you know, not like something that everybody's sending around in the biblical font. Be true to yourself and you will... I don't want that. I want your own spiritual, like, you know, things you realize has caused you, you know, some pearl of, like, your own, you know, wonderful, hard-earned wisdom. So, no, I got on a tangent. So it's harmful speech and dishonest speech. The third is slanderous speech. We all know that. And to define it for you, it's talking about somebody who's not there saying something that you would not say directly to them and feel good about it. In other words, slandering is not talking about somebody who's not there, if you would, when they were present, say the exact same thing and feel that it was useful or it was okay. But if you say something about X and you wouldn't say it directly to their face, well, what am I engaging in? I'm engaging in cowardice, really, because I'm identifying with that part of me that feels I can't say to that person's face that they're schmuck, so I go over here, schmuck. And obviously, the bonding that we do, if I bond with you by saying, schmuck, that's not a real relationship. It's not about a connection. It's about simply pretending that we're better than somebody. And inevitably, in my experience, the things that I criticize other about are always stuff that I've spent a lot of time in my own life dealing with. You know, when I was a kid, I still am today, but I was a worse know-it-all, right? And so when I see somebody as a know-it-all, you know, that's, you know, they don't know it all. because whatever we spend a lot of time working with and dealing with and struggling with, if somebody else just acts out on it, then they become a representation of all we've been at war with. So it's often a form of not acknowledging my own struggles. It's a false bonding, and it's a form of cowardice. And none of those traits are really skillful, worthwhile traits to develop for my lasting happiness. The last is idle chatter, and don't worry, it's not a friendly remark or talking.
how about them, whatever. Yeah, I don't follow sports, but whatever. I actually do follow soccer, so how about that Arsenal team? You know, that's fine. But it's not about that. What it is that kind of nervous chatter that, A, fills up silence because we feel uncomfortable when there's silence, or B, this is my favorite kind of idle chatter, when somebody has stumbled upon an uncomfortable subject and we quickly fill up the void to divert the attention. My family was amazing at this. Because we had our fair share of elephants in the room, and whenever somebody would point out an elephant in the room, you know, we'd immediately fill it up with chatter to divert from the subject that you just raised. So, in any event, when we engage in idle chatter, what we're doing is we're identifying with this part of us that feels it can't be with silence, or that it can't allow people to acknowledge things, that we have to control what people are focusing on, what people are thinking. Again, that creates an unsustainable form of stress. So every time we engage in dishonesty, harmfulness, slanderous speech, or idle chatter, what we're doing is identifying with a small, vulnerable, confused, threatened part of the mind. And that's really at depth why we want to use every interaction as a practice to identify with the healing parts of the mind, the larger parts, the parts of the mind that don't feel so vulnerable, that don't feel so threatened. So the core of working and developing is very simple, and I'm just going to introduce a few of them. The first is to note where in my life I engage in speech that I'm not happy about afterwards. It's very simple to do this. There's two things to look out for. Whenever I engage in an interaction and afterwards I'm filled with what the Buddha called kriya or papancha, which is a lot of internal self-justification. Well, I didn't really have to tell them all the shit that went on when they were away. I didn't really have to acknowledge this, or I was all right to say that to them. Whenever I'm justifying myself, justifying what I've done, that means there's something not right going on. In my experience, when I've done something that's toward, that I feel good about, that I feel easeful about, it doesn't create a lot of self-justification. It doesn't create a lot of narrative. It doesn't create a lot of reasoning behind it. So whenever I have an interaction and then afterwards there's this trail of verbiage, it's something to note and to investigate and say, okay, this is an arena of an interaction, a person that's triggering me. Also, there's the physical arena. Sometimes it won't come about in terms of thoughts or self-justification, but sometimes it'll just be physical tension. Afterwards, I'll feel sort of slimy if I've been gossiping about somebody. I'll feel sort of slimy if I've said something mean-spirited. So to feel that discomfort in the body, that sense of just not feeling good in one's own skin. So this is one, we note. We don't add judgment, we just simply note. Okay, in this interaction, I did something that didn't feel good. So the next time I'm in this similar situation with this person or in the same kind of situation, I bring my awareness. The second is to pause, develop the ability to pause. We often in life don't feel we have the right to pause before we respond because we feel that somebody will just start talking again. We feel that, you know, our truth won't get heard. It's if you're in an environment where the only way you get heard is by having to talk immediately before you can even think and pause and relax the body, it's not a good situation anyway to be conveying information. So the goal is to relax, pause, breathe deeply, search for any areas of stress and relax it. If there's this physical feeling in the body that I have to speak, I have to get this out, that means I'm not yet ready. Wise speech comes from a calm body. It sounds odd, but in my experience, whenever I'm physically at ease, whenever I'm comfortable, I don't say things I regret. But when I send those emails that are more harshly worded than I would have them be in retrospect, it's almost always because I was hunched over the keyboard, stressed out, with my face wanting to merge with the keyboard so that they could feel how angry I am. That's the mouse. So it's very important to pause, relax, breathe. The third is to ask ourselves, is this something I'm about to say that I'm sure I'll feel good about? One way to do this is to trick ourselves. I often, before I say something that's important, I will ask myself, you know, if somebody was tape recording this, would I feel comfortable? If somebody was writing down what I was saying, or if this was being broadcast to a billion Chinese people, would I feel good about this? In general, if I'm about to say something that I won't feel good about in the future, I shouldn't be saying it now. Another way of looking at this is, would I want somebody to say this to me, or could I imagine somebody that I respected saying what I'm about to say? However you do it, develop some mental check, litmus test, to make sure that it's something that you're sure is going to be worthwhile. Especially in the arenas where we've seen that we've caused or spoken in ways that are unskillful. And finally, silence. Silence is the most underutilized, potent tool in the human communication arsenal. There's no more cutting a rebuke to an idiot than silence. Nothing enshrines an idiotic remark in its total idiocy than responding to it with silence. Too often, when somebody says something antagonistic, stupid, hurtful, we try to somehow force them to see how stupid the remark was, when in fact the most perfect way to hold up the idiocy for all to see is to encase it in utter silence. It's a skill that has been taught to me by many monks that I've studied with when I've asked them questions. Seriously, when I was quite a while ago, I went on a retreat with a wonderful monk, and I was so wanting him to see how wise I was. He just looked at me with this, and just, you know, and just forced me to sit there with these questions. It's a really wonderful technique. So that's wise speech, why it's important, and how to work with it. I hope you got something out of it. I thank you for listening. And now we need a... after I turn off...